Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times, the News and Observer, and National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Our journey on today's Armchair Traveler begins with an article headlined, Quarantine and Travel, Strict Penalties, Rare Enforcement. It's written by Lauren Schloss and appeared in the August 21st, 2020 issue of the New York Times. Mika Salamanca's mugshot is a departure from most of the images you'll find of her online, particularly the ones she posts on Instagram to her 1 million-plus followers, winsome selfies and playful portraits with her head cocked to the side. But in the photograph released by the Honolulu Police Department, Ms. Salamanca, a social media influencer from the Philippines, stares directly into the camera, her expression inscrutable. Ms. Salamanca was arrested in Honolulu, Hawaii on July 24th for having broken the state's mandatory 14-day quarantine. She was apprehended after posting images and videos out with friends within days of her arrival, leading a group of locals to report her to authorities. One day it will all make sense, reads an Instagram post from August 4th, which racked up more than 33,000 likes. Whether it makes sense or not, Ms. Salamanca's transgression, subsequent arrest, and public apology is one of the more titillating and public examples of quarantine enforcement in the United States. But as quarantine requirements for travelers have become increasingly common throughout the United States, in states including New York, Vermont, and Kentucky, plus the city of Chicago, the prevailing theme is the difficulty of effective enforcement. Roughly 6 months into the coronavirus pandemic, local and state governments have struggled to contain the spread of the coronavirus with limited manpower and dwindling resources, and following quarantine rules is more often than not left to the traveler's discretion. Officials hope that threats of fines or imprisonment, and more crucially, an honor code state of mind, will prove effective. But as issues of right and wrong become increasingly muddied in our ever-shifting pandemic world, can travelers be counted on to do the right thing? Hawaii's quarantine order for trans-Pacific travelers went into effect on March 26th and currently applies to everyone who enters the state. Governor David Uggie further instituted a partial quarantine requirement for inter-island travel beginning August 11th. Those caught breaking quarantine can be fined up to $5,000 or imprisoned for up to 1 year. In contrast, most other states' quarantine orders are only required for travelers coming from places experiencing high infection rates. In New York, that currently includes more than 30 states, plus Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, according to a list that is updated weekly. Those who violate the quarantine order are subject to fines up to $10,000. Connecticut has started issuing $1,000 fines to visitors who fail to submit to a travel advisory form to its public health department or violate quarantine orders. Other states, including Ohio and New Hampshire, frame quarantine requirements as recommendations or requests without the threat of fines. Hawaii's geographic remoteness and the fact that it is, well, a group of islands, puts it at an advantage when it comes to monitoring who is coming or going. All travelers are required to fill out a form provided by the state's transportation department upon arrival, and quarantine enforcement is handled by individual counties. As of August 11th, the state reported 27 arrests on Oahu, 22 in Maui County, 29 on the Big Island, and 60 on Kauai, according to Krishna Jarajam, the special assistant to the state attorney general. This program, like everything else, is with COVID is something of a learning process, said Mr. Jayaram. We have become aware of someone who may be violating the order. We conduct a pretty thorough investigation. Many investigations are spurred by concerned citizens, some of whom are banding together on social media to root out quarantine violators. A YEI quarantine capo breakers, who alerted the authorities to Miss Salamanca's transgressions, write that their purpose is to bring awareness to issues surrounding tourists and locals not adhering to public safety standards during the pandemic. Miss Salamanca did not respond to requests for comment. Incidents of community policing have also been reported in Florida, South Carolina, and Kentucky, plus examples of particularly vigilant enforcement against Americans attempting to sneak into Canada. Quarantine violations seem particularly egregious in Hawaii, where comparatively the rules are unambiguous. Brad Johnson, who lives in Maui, traveled to Kentucky in early June to be with his ailing father. Mr. Johnson noted that upon returning to Hawaii weeks later, it was virtually impossible to exit the airport without filling out a form and interacting with government officials, including the Hawaii National Guard. He was required to provide his phone number and told to turn on his location services. Still, he noticed that a number of people who had been on his flight were pushing back both in transit and upon arrival. By the way, turning on location services is reference to your device, your phone device. There were maybe a dozen people who were not wearing masks and kind of creating a ruckus, he said. I saw one of these women arguing with officials and refusing to turn on her phone's tracking. She was visiting family. It was her right. They were violating it. The officials made it clear that her option was to get back on the plane and go back. Mr. Johnson was contacted twice by government officials to make sure that he was abiding by the rules. Other states, in contrast, are making enforcement a much lower priority. Furthermore, the rules of what is and isn't allowed are less clear. New York also requires visitors from its changing list of hotspot states to fill out a form sharing their location and contact information. But the threat of enforcement remains lower than that of Hawaii, not least because of the sheer number of visitors and the disparate entry points. Since the first quarantine order was issued on June 25th, the state's health department has worked in partnership with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey to ensure that health officials are stationed at airports and positioned by flights arriving from applicable states to hand out and collect forms. Those who refuse are subject to a $2,000 fine. On August 5th, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced plans to set up checkpoints on metro area bridges and tunnels, plus similar setups at Penn Station and the Port Authority bus terminal. But details of the plan were scarce and somewhat confusing. According to Amanda Kwan, a senior public information officer at the Port Authority, the Port Authority has been in contact with the city, and their effort will have no operational impact to any of our facilities. All vehicle checkpoints, she said, are being set up off of Port Authority property without Port Authority personnel. As of August 14th, the majority of stops made were on Staten Island, while only 36 vehicles entering Manhattan were stopped. Bethany Mitchell returned home to New York on July 14th from San Francisco, having left the city in March to stay with her boyfriend when her work as a performer with the Battery Dance Company dried up. She wanted to try her best to follow the quarantine rules, but found some of the ask unclear or unfeasible. "I hadn't been in my apartment for months, or 4 months," she says. "I had to go to the grocery store and pharmacy to do things to function," she said. She looked into delivery options for her groceries, but found that it was prohibitively expensive. She also got tested shortly after arriving. When she got her results a week later, she began seeing friends from a distance in parks. "My mindset was, at least I didn't bring it from California." According to Governor Andrew M. Cuomo's office, a negative coronavirus test is not a pass from quarantine, but this information can be hard to find. It's on page 6 of an online FAQ, and for a number of states, including Vermont, Alaska, and Connecticut, a negative test is a quarantine pass. In lieu of clear guidelines and regular check-ins, Ms. Mitchell said that she made choices that felt safe, financially viable, and rational to her. She was contacted by the state health department once on day 13 of the quarantine period. The governor's office could not share numbers of those caught violating quarantine in New York. The desire to do what is right is common, but defining that is difficult as people receive mixed messages. Dr. Iraz Yelly, a research scientist at MIT's Sloan School of Management and director of the Applied Cooperation Team, said that the lack of consistency in the rules on the national, state, and even city levels leads to ambiguity, which leaves room for plausible deniability. That makes it hard to make these rules social norms, he said. Without those social norms, there's no way that society can enforce the rules informally. Still, soft enforcement remains central to many of these quarantine plans. Dr. Allison Iwadi, commissioner of Chicago's Public Health Department, said at a recent news conference, "Our primary objective is about educating and informing the public. Chicago is currently requiring 2-week quarantine from 19 states and Puerto Rico." Dr. Iwadi noted that while the city does have the ability to issue fines of $100 to $500 per day, enforcement is not her main goal. "I have absolutely no intention of pulling cars over that have out-of-state license plates," or, she added, "developing watch lists of people flying through the airports." This leaves some businesses in a challenging position. Hotels, for instance, can receive guest reservations from a variety of sources, online platforms like Expedia, travel agents, direct booking on their websites that provide varying degrees of data and information about where a guest is coming from if they would be required to quarantine. "When it comes from our website, we can get more information from people," said Robert Baum, a partner at Betterman Lodging, a hotel group based in Chicago. "But even then, we have a better shot of knowing where they live rather than where they were most recently." Mr. Baum said he has reached out to the city for advice on how to deal with guests. In the meantime, Betterman is emailing all guests coming to its 3 hotels to inform them of the city's rules and further reminding them during the check-in process. Again, the hotels aren't necessarily able to track whether or not guests are coming from hotspot states. They are checking passports or parsing credit card statements. "Unlike other retail businesses, it's pretty much a guarantee that people are coming in from other places," Mr. Baum said. "It puts our staff in a challenging position. When there's no real way for us to police these quarantine rules, it's hard for us to reassure them." Chicago city officials, did not share numbers of those who had been caught violating quarantine orders. The patchwork of quarantine rules, not dissimilar from differing norms regarding mask usage and social distancing, seeds confusion, says Dr. Yelly. Confusion, he adds, introduces this ability to act in your own self-interest, but he still thinks it's worth trying to establish more effective social norms. "Everyone wants guidance. Everyone wants to be okay," he said. "I think that everyone would find it something of a relief to have a clearer idea of what to do." Indeed, that is the case, isn't it? Well, we're going to change directions now as we switch from state-to-state travel. And what you need to know before traveling abroad is the next article, written by Los Angeles Times reporter Christopher Reynolds. It appeared in the August 30th, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. The U.S. State Department on August 6th relaxed its pandemic warnings about international travel, which means more Americans may be thinking about big trips. For those planning international vacations, there are at least 2 big questions to consider. The first one is your passport. If you need a new or renewed passport, it's difficult to predict when you might receive it. Though the State Department has chipped away at its backlog of passport applications, it still has a long way to go and reduced workforce at its passport offices nationwide. The agency says its main priority now is processing passport requests for life or death emergencies, and it won't estimate how long it will take to process conventional requests, whether new or in the pipeline. However, Los Angeles Times readers have shared anecdotal reports of wait times of 5 weeks to more than 3 months. In Weatherford, Texas, VB submitted her passport renewal on May 22nd and finally received an email it will be mailing to us on August 12th, but some parts of the process move faster than others. GB, who is married to VB, wrote that their check cleared the bank in less than a week after mailing the application. In Pleasanton, California, Eric Scherer said he submitted his passport renewal in early July. "I think I am happy to report that I received the passport back today," Scherer wrote August 8th. "I say thank because I had the photo taken with full-on pandemic hair." In Diamond Bar, California, Randy Kung said he had applied for a passport renewal during the week of April 5th in the early weeks of the passport office's closure and signed up for email notification of his application status. More than 3 months later, on July 27th, he received email notification. On July 30th, the passport arrived. The State Department updates its passport backlog statistics every Thursday. On August 6th, officials reported that they'd issued 213,000 passports in the previous week and received 139,000 applications. That left the agency's backlog at 1.06 million, a number that officials say is not uncommon for the busiest weeks in a normal year. The State Department's passport pages include details and contact information, which offices are open, how the process works, how you may be able to get a status update, and why the agency continues to cash checks promptly while running behind in its other tasks. The short answer, government workers can process your payments while working from home, but can handle secure documents such as birth certificates only in a government office, and in most of those remain at a reduced capacity right now. Now, the next question is about your destination. The State Department has backed off its warnings in place since March that Americans should avoid all international travel. The move follows major advances made by many nations in reducing COVID-19 cases and deaths. However, as a spokesperson said, health and safety conditions are improving in some countries and potentially deteriorating in others. Also, many countries are wary of American visitors because U.S. infection and death totals are higher than everyone else's. The European Union has kept the U.S. on its list of countries whose travelers are most stringently restricted. The United Kingdom continues to require a 14-day quarantine. Meanwhile, State Department officials urge would-be travelers to check out the department's updated country-by-country risk level rankings of 1 to 4. 1 for exercise normal precautions, to 4 for do not travel. Mexico has a 4 ranking, do not travel, and Canada has a 3 ranking, reconsider travel. But Canada also forbids Americans from making non-essential visits north of the border. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is another excellent source of travel advice. The federal agency does its own country-by-country analysis and continues to urge that staying home is the best way to protect yourself and others from COVID-19. The CDC's country rankings use 3 risk categories, 1 for low, 2 for moderate, and 3 for high. North and South America and most of Europe and Asia are rated high risk. New Zealand and Thailand are among the handful of countries with low risk assessments. The CDC analyses also give details on case counts from country to country. You can find more on country-specific pandemic information on the World Health Organization web. That's WHO, okay? So check out that website if you have information considering traveling abroad. Well, COVID-19 certainly has become a major obstacle for travelers, but the virus is not the only barrier for those who enjoy exploring the world around us. For example, recent storms in the Raleigh area created flash floods that quickly made some low-lying roads momentarily impassable. Or even worse, required the rescue of drivers and or passengers who were caught in the torrents of water. In his article, The Climb of His Life, Robbie Schoen shares an amazing story of travel survival beneath the earth amid rapidly rising water levels. As the subhead reads, when the world's deepest known cave fills with water, a photographer traveling with elite Russian explorers must scramble to survive. His story, found in the August 2020 issue of National Geographic. I had just begun breakfast on September 16, 2018, when we received the radio call. A flood pulse was coming. It would reach us in 30 minutes. Photo assistant Jeff Wade and I were camped some 6,890 feet below ground with members of the Perovo-Spaleo caving team, an elite group of Russian cavers who are pushing the boundaries of exploration. We'd been underground for 11 days in the deepest known cave in the world, the Veryakina system in Absakazia, a self-declared republic in the country of Georgia. 2 days earlier, I had taken the photograph you see above, and it is pictured here, and it's interesting. It's kind of like a green, watery pond in the center with cold, dark walls of this cave. So it's, and I say cold, it looks like just the luminous amount of coal surrounding it. I'm sure it's another kind of geologic formation, but it is dark nonetheless. He writes that 2 days earlier I'd taken the photograph seen, and expedition leader Pavel Demidov climbing out of the terminal slump. That's the cave's deepest point, so he's just above that point in this picture. Flood pulses, when a sudden accumulation of water bursts through any opening it can find, happen often in caves, and at first we weren't concerned. We learned later that there'd been a week of rain above ground. Our 8-person tent was pitched in a side passage halfway up a chasm. We thought we'd be out of the way of the main flow of water. We continued with our breakfast. Well, I'll never forget the sound as if a freight train were about to crash through camp. It got louder and louder. Everyone stood open-mouthed, staring upward, wondering what was going to appear out of the darkness. Then an enormous torrent cascaded past our camp and plummeted deeper into the chasm. We decided to wait and see how it would develop. Sometimes flood pulses pass quickly. After a couple of hours, Petra Lobanov, one of the Russian cavers, noted gurgling coming from a deep hole on the edge of the camp where we'd been spitting our toothpaste. Pavel and Audrey Shuvalov left to check the water levels deeper in the cave system. Shortly after they'd gone, Petra inspected the toothpaste hole again. When he turned around, his white face said it all. The hole was full of water. The water was rising. We had to act fast. In camp, we wore only base layers, fleecy onesies to keep us warm. Over them, we hurriedly put on latex dry suits, Cordura oversuits, harnesses, and climbing gear. The others were used to this gear and were quick, but in the panic, Jeff and I had to help each other seal our dry suits. My equipment was spread all over the ground. I grabbed the memory cards from the camera, put them in a Ziploc bag and into my chest pocket. I left the rest. Every single hole around the camp was bubbling. "We're leaving right now," I said to Jeff. We hurried across a traverse that had skirted a 50-foot drop. That drop was now a lake, and we were only 3 feet above water. I turned to Petra and shouted, "Come on, Petra, we have to evacuate camp." He said he would wait for Pavel and Audrey to come back. I thought I would never see them again. Using ascenders, we climbed ropes dangling through shafts that had become raging waterfalls. I don't know whether I was more scared of the rising water below or the torrent of water pummeling us from above. To breathe, we kept our heads down and tucked in our chins, creating a small airspace under the front of the helmet. It took every ounce of effort to move an inch at a time, and we had nearly 600 vertical feet to go. I was in the lead. If I couldn't get past an obstacle, everyone behind me would be stuck with no way out while the water rose. I panicked. I climbed so quickly that I lost sight of Jeff. I honestly thought that he and the others were dead, and then I heard a very angry voice behind me. Jeff was yelling at me to slow down. I was so relieved to hear him. Finally, we reached a temporary bivouac on a side passage where we could wait safely out of the water and cold wind. The first of the other cavers appeared, and we asked him if he'd seen anyone else. He said no. We assumed the rest were dead, though he didn't say so, or we didn't say it. We continued on to the next camp and waited. Then others started to appear. They'd managed to grab sleeping bags and a stove. Everyone had survived, though Petra had injured his knee badly. We couldn't climb further because the next waterfall led to a narrow horizontal passage that would be completely flooded. We waited 16 hours, trapped between the floodwaters below and an impassable waterfall above. The Russian cavers, feeling relatively safe, were soon laughing among themselves in the tent. Jeff and I paced outside, watching to see if the waters would rise again. We didn't take off our harnesses or any clothes. We wanted to be ready if anything happened. But finally, the flood died down. Jeff and I escorted the injured Petra to the next camp. The others went back down to try to salvage what they could from below. They came back with my camera and tripod, but said that one of my waterproof containers was wedged into the cave roof. It took us 4 days to get to the surface. We each reached the top alone. My senses are usually heightened after I emerge from a caving trip. Smells are stronger, colors more vivid, and sounds clearer. This time, everything seemed strangely dampened. I felt like a ghost living out my life as if it would have been, but I also have never felt such relief. I remember a blood-red moon sinking on the horizon of the Black Sea. 1 year later, Pavel and team member Kostya Zverev arrived at my home in Innsbruck, Austria. They put 2 bottles of vodka in the freezer and asked me to close my eyes. When I opened them, there on my kitchen table was some of the equipment I had left behind. No doubt Robbie Schoen has the story of a lifetime to share with friends in years ahead, huh? Well, in our remaining few minutes, let's conclude today's journey, first with Walking Back in Time in a Volcano's Shadow. And Michael Greshko is the writer. His article appearing in the September 2020 issue of National Geographic, and it's just a short article, but interesting. It reads, a Tanzanian villager has discovered a treasure trove of ancient footprints. 9 miles north of the volcano called the Old Dinyo Lingai, which means Mountain of God, researchers funded by the National Geographic Society have cataloged a rare find, more than 400 fossil footprints laid down by humans who walked and jogged across mud flats 10,000 to 19,000 years ago. Discovered along the shore of Tanzania's Lake Natron by local villager Kongo Saki, an Ngare Sero site lets scientists really start to see social behavior patterns in our Homo sapiens ancestors, says team leader Cynthia Lutkus-Pierce, a geologist at Appalachian State University. One set of tracks reveals 17 people walking toward the southwest, 14 of whom were probably adult women. That suggests a female-led foraging party, a division of labor used by some modern hunter-gatherers. To save Ngare Sero's trackways from erosion, researchers have 3D scanned them and are partnering with local officials to build a protective enclosure and workstation. In the meantime, Saki walks to Ngare Sero from his village every day at sunrise, keeping a watchful eye on those footprints he found. Quite a discovery and an interesting thing to do. That's something to keep in mind when you travel. If you maybe find something that others haven't discovered, and write it down and make sure you keep the location in mind as well to make it easier to revisit. Then we have some flamingos make friends in this part of the National Geographic called Explore Breakthroughs. It says the avian world's pink-feathered icons form long-lasting loyal friendship, scientists recently discovered. The flamingo bonds vary from mated couples that build nests and raise chicks each year to same-sex friends or groups of 3 to 6 close buddies. The relationships characterized by standing close together may last decades. Like humans, flamingos befriend those who get along with and avoid those that cause squabbles. Virginia Morrell is the writer there. I will recall, as I read this, the story of the San Diego zoo visit I had, pre-COVID, maybe 5-6 years ago, a little longer. And what a great afternoon. We spent all afternoon going through the zoo and got to the flamingo exhibit. I will tell you, they do stand together. It's just this massive color of flamingo. I mean, from one feather to the next, right on down to the last bird, and there were dozens and dozens of these birds. Quite the trip, and if you ever get a chance to go to San Diego, definitely put the zoo on your to-do list. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Be sure to listen next time. Hope you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.